All right, let's jump right in. Today, we're going deep, deep back into ancient Israel. We're talking Kings Ahab, Ahaziah, and Jehoram, and over Judah, Jehoshaphat and Jehoram. Lots of drama, lots of intrigue going on during their reigns.
Oh, yeah. It's a period packed with power struggles and shifting alliances. And, of course, you can't talk about this era without talking about Elijah and Elisha. They had a massive impact.
Huge. And that's actually what we're going to really dig into today. We're using Dr. Robert Vannoy's lecture notes as our guide. And one thing that really stood out to me was his focus on the timeline. It gets a bit tricky figuring out exactly when everything happened, but I think we can piece it together, kind of like a historical puzzle.
Absolutely. It's fascinating to see how these events fit together chronologically. And while we're doing that, we can explore how these prophets really shaped the course of these kingdoms.
Okay, so let's set the stage. We're starting right after that incredible showdown on Mount Carmel, you know, where Elijah just completely wipes out the prophets of Baal. It's such a powerful image. But then things take a sharp turn.
Yeah, it's a wild shift. One minute, he's calling down fire from heaven. The next, he's running for his life, hiding in a cave. It's almost like he goes from this peak of spiritual victory to utter discouragement.
Yeah, like a spiritual hangover or something.
That's a great way to put it. And this is where things get even more interesting. God appears to Elijah at Mount Horeb, not in the wind or earthquake, but in a still, small voice. What do you think about that?
I think it's a really powerful image, right? Mm. It shows that God's power isn't always this loud, flashy thing. Sometimes it's in the quiet moments, the stillness, that we really hear God's voice.
I agree. It's a lesson Elijah seems to learn, and maybe a lesson for all of us, too. And from there, he's given three tasks. Anoint Hazael as king of Aram, anoint Jehu as king of Israel, and choose his successor, Elisha.
Three big tasks. And each one kind of unfolds in a surprising way. It's not the typical pour oil on the head ceremony you might expect.
Right. It's much more nuanced than that. Let's start with Elisha. We have this incredible scene of Elijah ascending to heaven in a whirlwind. And Elisha, knowing what's about to happen, cries out for a double portion of Elijah's spirit. What do you make of that request?
Well, at first I thought he was asking for twice the power. But Dr. Vannoy points out that it's actually tied to inheritance laws in ancient Israel. The eldest son traditionally got a double portion of the inheritance. So Elisha's basically saying, hey, I want to be seen as your true heir, the one who carries on your legacy.
Exactly. It's about lineage and legitimacy. And of course, you have that moment where the Jordan River parts again, just like it did for Elijah, a clear sign that Elisha is the chosen successor.
Oh, yeah. And picking up Elijah's mantle, that's a powerful image of carrying on that prophetic tradition. Now, the anointing of Hazael is a whole different story. Elisha tells him he'll be king someday, but Hazael doesn't seem too thrilled about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's basically being told he's going to usurp the current king. Not exactly light news. And the way it actually happens, well, it's not exactly a peaceful transfer of power. Let's just say a cloak was involved.
Yeah, definitely not a typical coronation. Mm. And then there's Jehu, whose anointing involves this whole chain of command. Elisha sends another prophet to anoint him. But the timing is really interesting because it happens right when both the king of Israel and the king of Judah die.
Yeah, talk about a power vacuum. Jehu steps right into that chaos and quickly consolidates his power. But before we dive into his reign, I think we need to talk about a battle that's actually not mentioned in the Bible. The Battle of Qarqar.
The battle of what now?
Qarqar. It happened in 853 BC, and it involved the Assyrians, a major power at the time, clashing with a coalition of kings, including, get this, Ahab.
Wait, really? Mm. So Ahab was fighting on a much bigger stage than just against the Arameans.
Right.
But if it's not in the Bible, how do we even know about it?
The Assyrians were meticulous record keepers. They had this thing called the eponym list, which basically named each year after an important official, kind of like naming years after celebrities.
Interesting. So how did this list help us date the biblical events?
Well, in the year 763 BC, their list mentions a revolt and a solar eclipse. Astronomers can date eclipses precisely, so we know that entry refers to 763 BC. It's a fixed point.
Ah, okay. So we have one solid date. How do we get from there to Ahab and this Battle of Qarqar?
The Assyrian records also mention Qarqar, which happened 12 years before that eclipse year. So, boom, Qarqar was in 853 BC. And both the Assyrian and biblical sources agree that there's a 12-year gap between Qarqar and Jehu's rise to power.
Okay, so if we do the math, Jehu takes over in 841 BC. Wow, that's amazing. A battle that's not even in the Bible helps us nail down a more accurate timeline for everything else.
It really shows how important it is to look at all the available sources, not just the biblical text itself.
Totally. It's like putting together a puzzle using pieces from different boxes.
Yeah.
Okay, so now that we've got a better grip on the timeline, let's go back to Ahab. He's fighting the Assyrians on one side, trying to take back land from Damascus on the other. Sounds like he was constantly at war.
He was. And Dr. Vannoy even suggests that Ahab's attempts to grab land from Damascus might have been directly related to Qarqar. Maybe he was trying to build himself back up after that clash with the Assyrian Empire.
Makes sense. So Qarqar had these ripple effects, you know, shape what Ahab did next. And it all ends with him dying in battle, ironically trying to recapture that same territory, Ramoth-Gilead, he lost earlier in his reign.
It's kind of a full circle moment, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. A dramatic end to Ahab's story. But of course, it doesn't end there. His sons, Ahaziah and Jehoram, step onto the scene. Mm-hmm. And things, well, they don't exactly calm down. What can you tell us about these guys?
Ahaziah's reign was short and, let's just say, troubled. Remember that disastrous shipping venture he got involved in with Jehoshaphat? And then he takes a fatal fall and decides to seek help from a foreign god. Talk about bad timing.
Wow. He goes to a foreign god for help.
Ouch. Yeah, not exactly the best move. Now, Joram, he was a little less, shall we say, wicked than his father. He tried to make some reforms, like removing that sacred stone of Baal, but he didn't totally abandon idolatry.
Sacred stone? What was that all about?
It was probably a pillar or altar, something like that, dedicated to Baal. So taking it down was a symbolic way of saying, nope, we're not worshiping Baal anymore. But like I said, Joram didn't go all the way back to Yahweh.
So one step forward, two steps back kind of thing. It seems like these kings were always wrestling with those competing forces, you know, the pull of tradition versus the call to follow Yahweh.
Oh, absolutely. Their stories aren't simple. They were human with all the contradictions and complexities that come with that. And in the middle of all this religious tension, you've got these constantly shifting alliances. Joram teams up with Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom to fight Moab, for example.
It's like a political dance, isn't it? Everyone's switching partners depending on who's useful at the moment.
Yeah.
And it all leads to some pretty dramatic moments, like Joram getting wounded by the Syrians, recovering in Jezreel, and then bam, assassinated by Jehu. What a twist.
Yeah, Jehu's rise to power really shakes things up. And not just in Israel. Ahaziah, the king of Judah, gets caught in the crossfire and is killed too. Talk about a power vacuum. But we'll have to dive into all of that in the next part of our deep dive. Welcome back. Ready for more drama from ancient Israel and Judah?
Oh, yeah. Last time we left off with Jehu taking the throne. And it sounds like things are about to get even more intense.
Oh, definitely. Jehu doesn't mess around. He's on a mission divinely ordained to wipe out the house of Ahab and, well, get rid of Baal worship once and for all.
And if I remember correctly, he's not exactly known for his subtlety.
You got that right. Jehu's methods are, let's just say, effective. He systematically takes out anyone who might challenge him or who's standing in the way of his mission.
Sounds pretty ruthless. How does Dr. Vannoy explain this side of Jehu?
Well, he really stresses the importance of historical context. Baal worship had become deeply ingrained in Israelite society. It was seen as a direct threat to Yahweh.
So Jehu saw himself as like our restorer, bringing things back to the way they should be, you know, defending Yahweh's covenant with Israel.
Exactly. That perspective helps us understand why he went to such extremes, even though it doesn't necessarily justify everything he did. It shows how intertwined religion and politics were back then.
Yeah, good point. It's a reminder that history is never simple, black and white. Even people who might be considered heroes can have a dark side.
Absolutely. And that's what makes studying this period so fascinating. These stories force us to think about the nuances, the complex.
Okay, so while Jehu is shaking things up in the north, what's happening down in Judah? We left off with Jehoshaphat, who was Ahab's contemporary.
Jehoshaphat is a really interesting figure. He's generally seen as a good king, one who tried to follow Yahweh. He brought in some religious reforms and strengthened Judah's defenses.
But he also made some alliances that, well, maybe weren't the best in the long run, like getting involved with Ahaziah in that shipping venture that went so wrong. And then there's the alliance with Ahab, which led to his son marrying Ahab's daughter, Athaliah.
Right, those alliances probably seemed like good ideas at the time. Maybe he was thinking about political stability, economic benefits. But as we've seen, those choices had some unintended consequences.
And those consequences really come to a head with Athaliah. She's one of the most notorious figures in biblical history. What she does after Jehoram dies is just chilling.
It's a dark moment for sure. When her husband is killed, she seizes power and tries to wipe out the whole royal family.
Wow, total power grab. What would drive someone to do something that extreme?
Well, Dr. Vannoy suggests she was probably influenced by her upbringing. You know, growing up in the court of Ahab and Jezebel, where power struggles and intrigue were kind of the norm.
So she learned from the best, or maybe I should say the worst, when it came to playing the game of power.
That's one way to put it. She was ambitious, shrewd, and willing to do whatever it took to stay in control.
But her reign doesn't last forever, does it? There's got to be some hope here.
Don't worry, there is. A young boy named Joash, a direct descendant of David, is hidden away and protected from Athaliah. He represents the continuation of that Davidic line, which is so central to God's promises.
Okay, so we have a hidden heir. How does he eventually make his comeback?
It's a pretty daring rescue mission orchestrated by the high priest, Jehoiada. When Joash is 7 years old, Jehoiada reveals him to the people and proclaims him the rightful king.
I can only imagine the scene. The young boy, the cheering crowds, Athaliah's fury.
Must have been quite a moment. And it leads to a quick resolution. Athaliah is overthrown and executed, ending her reign of terror.
So order is restored in Judah, and the Davidic dynasty lives on.
For a time, yes. Joash's reign brings a period of stability, some much-needed renewal. He repairs the temple and brings back the proper worship of Yahweh.
It's a hopeful turn after all that darkness.
Right. It reinforces the idea that even in the midst of chaos and violence, the line of David and God's promises endure.
It's a powerful reminder of resilience, of hope for the future.
It is. But as with most stories from this era, things aren't quite that straightforward. Joash's reign, despite its good start, takes a tragic turn. But we'll have to explore that in the final part of our deep dive.
Oh, another cliffhanger. I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens next.
Stay tuned.
All right, we're back for the final chapter of our journey through ancient Israel and Judah. It's been a wild ride so far. We've seen epic showdowns, assassinations, and the powerful influence of prophets like Elijah and Elisha.
Definitely not a dull moment. And we even took a detour into ancient Assyrian records thanks to that eponym list. Really helped us get a clearer picture of the timeline.
Yeah, that was fascinating. But before we wrap things up, we got to circle back to Joash, that boy king of Judah who was dramatically rescued from Athaliah. Last we heard, things were looking pretty good for him.
Yeah, he had the temple repaired, got things back on track with, you know, worshiping Yahweh.
Mm.
But his story doesn't have a happy ending.
Oh, really? Mm. What happened? Dr. Vinoy's notes kind of hinted that things went south.
Well, after that promising start, Joash seems to stray from the right path. He lets idolatry creep back in, turns away from those reforms he started.
It's like that saying, power corrupts. You'd think after that whole dramatic escape from Athaliah, he'd be more focused on, you know, staying true to Yahweh.
You'd think so. But it seems the allure of power, maybe the influence of people around him, pulled him in a different direction. And of course, the prophets weren't going to let that slide.
Right. Someone's got to call out injustice and straying from Yahweh.
Exactly. And in this case, it's the prophet Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, who confronts Joash about his unfaithfulness. It's really poignant because remember, Jehoiada was the one who saved Joash as a boy.
Wow. That adds a whole other layer to it. Hmm. So how does Joash react to this this prophetic challenge?
Not well. He orders Zechariah to be stoned to death.
He killed the son of the man who saved him. That's cold. Seems like he completely lost his way.
It's a tragic turning point. Shows how far he fell from grace. And this act, it sets off a chain of events that leads to his own downfall.
So is this like a case of, you know, you reap what you sow?
Kinda, yeah. The Arameans, seeing Judah in turmoil, take advantage and invade. They plunder Jerusalem, and Joash is badly wounded, left for dead by his own officials.
What an end. From hidden heir to a forgotten king. I guess it shows that even with a dramatic start, things can go very wrong.
Definitely. It highlights how power can be fleeting, how important it is to, you know, stick to your principles.
Well, as we wrap up our deep dive into these kings and prophets, what are some key takeaways? What can we learn from their stories?
I think it reminds us that history is about real people, you know, their choices, their struggles, how their beliefs shaped everything.
Yeah, and we see those cycles of faithfulness and unfaithfulness, reform and corruption playing out over and over.
Right. And the impact of individual choices, both good and bad, is huge. Think about Elijah's stand on Mount Carmel or Athaliah's grab for power. Those choices had massive consequences.
And we can't forget the prophets, those voices calling people back to Yahweh, speaking truth to power.
Their words echo through these stories, reminding us that even in tough times, there's always hope, always a chance for renewal, always that promise of God's presence.
It's been an incredible journey through ancient Israel and Judah. We've met fascinating characters, witnessed dramatic events, and uncovered hidden connections. It's amazing how these stories, even though they're so old, still speak to us today.
Absolutely. They offer timeless lessons about leadership, faith, what it means to be human, and they remind us that even though these events happened thousands of years ago, they still resonate in our own time.
That's the power of history, right? It challenges us to learn from the past, wrestle with tough questions, find wisdom in the stories of those who came before us.
I agree. And it encourages us to keep asking questions, keep exploring, keep digging deeper.
Well, thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you've learned something new and maybe gained a new appreciation for these ancient stories. Until next time, keep exploring and keep learning.